Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Preventing DVT conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 18th, 2007. I would now like to turn the conference over to Alvin Weil from Premier. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mark, and greetings to everybody from Premier here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we help hospitals improve clinical and financial performance. Welcome to today's program, Preventing DVT, a case study approaches for implementing a systematic approach for the prevention of DVT.
Hello, everyone. This is Kelly Hicks, and I want to first introduce our speakers today and give them an opportunity to meet you. We are pleased to have representatives today from three different healthcare organizations. First, we welcome to our program Alpesh Amin. He's the executive director of the hospital program and the vice chair for clinical affairs and quality department of medicine at the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Amin?
Yeah, hi. It's a pleasure to be on the call with you all today. I also serve as medical director of our anticoagulation services and have been one of the thought leaders and published in the area of venous thromboembolism and helped develop some of our guidelines and pathways here. And so I look forward to discussing some of the opportunities to improve your healthcare system in terms of prevention of venous thromboembolism.
Thank you. We also have John Lemoyne, who is also a physician. He's the system medical director at Sharp Healthcare in San Diego, California.
Good day. Most people call me Rick. I'm down here in sunny San Diego today. Sharp Healthcare is a multi-hospital organization in San Diego. We're the biggest healthcare provider here in San Diego County. I'm a pulmonologist and intensivist by training and was involved for a number of years in research in venous thromboembolic disease with Ken Moser out of San Diego. And these days, what I spend a lot of my time doing is trying to get organizations that were originally separate hospitals and separate medical staff to cooperate on system-wide protocols for treating and also for preventing DVT, and I hope to share some of our experience in that regard with you later today.
Thank you for being with us today. We also have Jennifer Bergenon, who is a nurse practitioner, clinical outcome specialist from Spartanburg Regional Health System in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Jennifer?
Hi, Caroline. Hi, Alvin. I'm glad to be able to participate on this program with you today and share some of what we have learned about VTE prevention in Spartanburg Regional in my role as a clinical outcome specialist.
Thanks, Jennifer. Just to give everybody a quick overview of the format, Kelly and I will interview the speakers for the first 30 minutes or so of the program. Your phone lines have been placed on mute for this interview portion of the call. Then we'll open the phone lines up for you to ask questions or make comments live, so please go ahead and jot down your questions as we move along. You should have received an email link to a number of reference materials, such as some PDFs regarding physician order sets, risk assessment, as well as DVT research slides. These materials are for your reference after the program. On Friday this week, you can also download the audio file from our website, www.premierinc.com/advisor-live. We'll have help from our Global Crossings operator, Mark.
So let's get started. We will ask each panelist similar questions so they can share their different approaches and experiences with DVT prevention with you. And we will get started with Dr. Amin and have him give us a good overview of DVT. Dr. Amin, if you would please just set the stage for us, since we have varying levels of experience on the lines of our participants today. What is DVT and is it preventable?
Well, thank you, Kelly. DVT stands for deep vein thrombosis, and it is what many of us now think of as a spectrum with pulmonary embolism that causes a disease state called venous thromboembolism. Deep vein thrombosis is really a blood clot that can occur anywhere in one's body. Dr. Virchow, 150 years ago, described the risk factors for DVT and venous thromboembolism, which are and the three major categories of risk factors are patients that have a hypercoagulable state, some sort of injury or trauma, venous injury or trauma, or have stasis of to some regard, and there's multiple causes of each one of those three categories that can lead to a patient developing a blood clot. This blood clot, if it breaks off and goes to the lung or other parts of the body that affect end organs, can have significant morbidity and mortality associated with it. So one of the things, 150 years ago, Dr. Virchow helped us describe the risk factors, but there wasn't a lot of opportunity to help prevent these until the last few decades, where we've actually been able to come up with methods to actually prevent venous thromboembolism. And so, yes, the question of whether it is preventable, it is absolutely preventable, and there are things that we can do about it, which makes it now our responsibility as healthcare providers to do something about preventing this deadly disease state that affects a significant amount of morbidity and mortality nationally.
Doctor, I mean, how prevalent is DVT?
I'm glad you asked that, because DVT, the prevalence is on the order of 2 million cases a year, but just to put it into some context that makes some sense, about 40% of DVT cases can end up developing complications such as post-thrombotic syndrome. And another 300,000 or so of these DVTs, if they form a pulmonary embolism, based on the recent data from last year, there's about 300,000 deaths from venous thromboembolism. Now, that is a significant amount of morbidity and mortality, especially when you can do something about prevention of it. And when you think about this, there is on the order of 400,000 to 600,000 deaths from an acute MI. So you're talking about a disease state that has the same order of magnitude of mortality as an acute MI. And when you actually add up the death toll from breast cancer and liver disease, HIV, and accidents, you still get more deaths from venous thromboembolism. So number one, it is a very significant disease with a high prevalence, but number two, it is actually preventable, and the complications are preventable, along with the mortality that's associated with it is preventable, and so which makes it now our onus to do something about it.
Well, Dr. Armin, I know that you have partnered with Premier to do some research studies regarding DVT. Can you tell us more about that and where the data came from and what did you learn from these research studies?
Sure, I'll be glad to. So we did a research study which we're really proud of, the research was a retrospective observational study of practice trends and patterns in acute care hospitals using the Premier Perspective database. And what we did was we looked at over 75,000 surgical patients and 200,000 medical patients that were discharged from hospitals between January of 2002 to September of 2005. Now, I think people, and this totaled about 227 or so hospitals around the country. So when you look at the quality of the research, we certainly had large numbers, and we certainly had a wide distribution of hospitals around the United States. And we decided to compare this to see how folks were doing in these hospitals, both on the medical and surgical side, and to see where they were practicing according to the 6 consensus American College of Physician guidelines. Now, the ACCP, which has been publishing guidelines for prevention of venous thromboembolism since 1984, and we're now on the 7th version, these guidelines are considered the gold standard and have been out there for many, many years. So people should know about these. And we included, our inclusion criteria had discharges with patients above the age of 40 that stayed in the hospital for more than 5 days, had at least one definable risk factor for venous thromboembolism, according to the ACCP guidelines, had no contraindication to venous thromboembolism prophylaxis, and was not transferred from another acute care facility. And we asked a very simple question, that according to the national gold standard guidelines over a three-plus year period in a large population of patients, were we giving appropriate, number one, were we giving prophylaxis to these patients that deserved it according to the guidelines? And number two, if we were giving prophylaxis, were we giving it appropriately in terms of either mechanical or pharmacological, in terms of duration, as well as in terms of dosage? And that was the question that we decided to ask. And what we found was that at best, in the acute medical population, in patients that had significant underlying risk factors, and if you look at the data based on the Mednox trial and several other trials, the average number of risk factors of our patients that come into the hospital with risk factors for deep vein thrombosis or venous thromboembolism is on the order of 3 to 5 risk factors. So with that, and we know that that there's been data that's been published that shows that as your number of risk factors increase, it's obvious that your chances of developing a venous thromboembolism goes up. So in patients that had significant underlying risk factors on the medical side, less than 40% of these patients, and certainly less than 50%, actually got any form of prophylaxis. And when we looked at the surgical side, orthopedics did okay. They had somewhere around 70% prophylactic rate, but everybody else, every other surgical condition, whether it was gynecological, urologic, general surgery, everybody else had less than 30% prophylaxis. And again, this isn't all patients. These are patients that had indications and no contraindications to receiving prophylaxis. We're looking at that subset of patients, and our outcomes are showing less than 50% on the medical side and less than 30% on the surgical side, except for orthopedics, which was up in around the 70% range. So when we looked at this data even further and trended it over time in the surgical population, we went from a whopping 25% to a whopping 35% or so over a three-year period in getting surgical prophylaxis done in their surgical patients. So, you know, even the trend of increasing our outcomes has been very poor across the nation. And when you look at it in the medical population, we've gone from a 25% over this three-year period to about just shy of 40%. So even though we're making some progress, it's very slow and not appropriate according to most people's standards. The data that medical illnesses and broke it down by individual disease categories also showed a significantly low compliance by quarter, and same thing with the surgical side. And then we broke this data down by region and looked at it across the regions to see if there was any region that was doing it better than the other. And the Mid-Atlantic scored the highest at 40%, but I'll remind you that means that 60% of them that should have gotten some sort of prophylaxis actually didn't. And when we broke it down by attending specialty, we also couldn't find an attending specialty that did it well. Cardiology did it about 40% of the time, internal medicine about 35% of the time, oncology about 25% of the time, and so we couldn't find a specialty that did it better than 40%.
urban and rural, there was no real significant difference. Teaching versus non-teaching, there was no real significant difference. Both were about 35% or so. I think non-teaching was 32%, and teaching hospitals were about 35%. When we broke it down by payer mix, also it was less than 40% whether they were funded or needed governmental support. And we when we looked at it by hospital bed size, thinking that the larger the hospitals, the more resources and the more up-to-date that these hospitals would be. We ranged from 0 to 99 beds up to 500 beds and went from 25% to about 35-38%. So, again, we didn't really make any significant progress in that regard either. Referral sources didn't show about 30% whether it came from the emergency department or outside physicians. So our data and our research, which, by the way, got presented at the CHEST National Meeting last October and won the Alfred Sofer Award, because we believe it's not that this research was necessarily a unique research design, but it was because of the importance of this disease state. But what we found was that there was a significant gap in adherence to the American College of Chest Physician guidelines and surgical medical patients. Two out of three patients did not receive recommended prophylaxis that was appropriate. Rates of orthopedic surgery were significantly higher than other surgical procedures, but still they were missing 30%. Care processes across the specialties may require further study, and more effort is required to increase awareness of thromboprophylaxis according to national guidelines. And I'll leave you with a quote from Bruce Avott, who's the chief of hematologic diseases at the CDC. And what he has said is that there is a call to action here. And his comment was, deep vein thrombosis is preventable. We can reduce the risk of its serious and life-threatening complications if we raise education and awareness among the public and urge all healthcare providers to institute standard preventative measures. On that note, Kelly, I hope that gave everybody a good background of where we are in our state of affairs, and I'll hand it back over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Amin, and please note that the research that Dr. Amin was referencing was sent to you in the aforementioned email. Now let's hear from some of our other health systems on the programs that they're doing and the research they're doing along the lines of DVT. Dr. LeMoyne, can you share with us some demographic information first off about Sharp Healthcare? Give us an understanding of your organization.
Sure. Sharp Healthcare, as I mentioned earlier, is the largest provider in San Diego County. Right now we operate four acute care general hospitals. One of them is a smaller hospital over on the island of Coronado. The other three are about 400 beds each, which is pretty standard size in Southern California. We also have a large specialty women's hospital and some other facilities as well. We have two large medical groups, all of which sometimes the fields are pulling in somewhat different directions, which is part of the challenge in terms of getting everybody on the same page.
Thank you, Dr. LeMoyne. And now if you could please talk to us about your DVT prevention program at Sharp and what are some of the barriers that you have had to overcome in doing so?
Sure. Well, I think one of the interesting things about deep vein thrombosis versus other conditions that we deal with and try to deal with is there's just lately so much known about this problem. The science behind it is very good. There is really, as has been mentioned, no excuse why we can't do a better job with this. So one of the barriers has been trying to hardwire an approach to categorizing patients as to their risk, making sure that their risk is identified, and then getting medical groups and medical staff to agree on a standard approach. You know, I always go back to one of the lines of David Nash that independent variance is really the enemy of good quality practice. When the science is known, when the tools are available, What we have to do in order to get good results for our patients is try and make sure that those tools are applied in as uniform and as regular a way as possible. Now, one of the things that makes Sharp a little bit different than some of the other organizations is our commitment to the Six Sigma process. And Six Sigma has been extremely useful for us in terms of the way we approach a particular problem and then the way that we try and implement solutions to it. And rather than go into some of the specifics about DBT, let me just give some examples about how we use the Six Sigma process to get medical staff together, to get nursing groups together when they have never done those kinds of things. Six Sigma teaches us that even if we have a good idea, the idea is not enough. The strategy isn't enough. One has to have the acceptance by the audience, by our physicians, by our other clinicians, to be able to put these ideas and solutions into practice. So Six Sigma gives us the tools to hold better meetings. I mean, that may seem very mundane, but if you don't know how to get your point across, if you don't know how to engage the recalcitrant doc at the back of the room who's going to go out and say bad things about your program after the meeting, you're going to fail. So it's the attention to detail that the Six Sigma process brings to the table, which can be incredibly useful in terms of moving the goalposts forward in this regard. The other thing that Sharp is doing is that we've just started to implement a new electronic medical record system across our entire entity so that we will have one order set, one-stop shopping, similar protocols across all of our facilities. And that is, implementing that, again, has been highly dependent upon the Six Sigma process to be able to make that happen.
Thank you, Dr. Lemoyne. One more question for you, if I could. What methods do you use to measure process improvements?
Well, our process improvements are really tied in with our ability to use our EMR and tools out of the Six Sigma toolbox, as it's called. So we use both the clinical decision support features from our EMR and supplement that with real live touch the patient, touch the doctor audits to see if we are adequately categorizing patients as to their level of risk, if the protocols that we would that we would want to apply to this particular patient have been implemented properly. And then at the end of the day, of course, we try and look at our rate of DVT to see whether or not the final measurements have been done. So it really is trying to take a holistic approach to it, but using some of the new tools and techniques that are available through electronic medical records, through clinical decision support, and tie that in with a Six Sigma approach.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Lemoyne, for that information. I think we will move to the other side of the country at this point and talk to Jennifer Bergenon about Spartanburg Regional Health System. Jennifer, tell us a little bit about your hospital and then talk to us about your DVT prevention program as well.
Okay. Well, Spartanburg Regional is a 588 licensed bed teaching and research hospital located in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains, so I guess you could say we're kind of rural. We provide health care services to a five-county area in North and South Carolina, and these services include a heart center, which, by the way, was named best in the state by HealthGrades, with an ACC-accredited chest pain center, a Joint Commission-certified stroke center, a level one trauma center with an EC that sees 80 to 100,000 visits per year. We also have a full-service cancer center affiliated with MD Anderson and a certified bariatric center, and I'd also like to point out that we were the first magnet hospital in the state of South Carolina. Our prevalent lifestyle in the South is reflected in our major illnesses, cancer, stroke, renal failure with dialysis, diabetes, and heart disease. Do you want me to go right to the next question?
If you want to, talk to us about your DVT prevention programs. And
okay.
Go ahead.
All righty. Our DVT prevention program is, if you'll pardon the cliche, a work in progress. As is the case with most initiatives, the more you know about a problem, the more variables and dynamics are identified, each of them presenting their own unique barriers. However, the first and major barrier for DVT prophylaxis was physician acceptance and changing practice patterns. Overcoming the attitude that VTE is a random event out of my control versus a bleed in the hospital is my fault continues even today. VTE is a potentially preventable complication of hospitalization was first addressed in our hospital in 2004 when cases of DVT or PE going to peer review were unable to be classified as appropriate or inappropriate care because we had no institutionally defined standard of care. A team of physicians representing all the major specialties met throughout that year and developed the DVT risk assessment tool, which you can find on the website, and the DVT prophylaxis order form. These tools were released in December of 2004. We tracked the use of the form, the rate of the prophylaxis ordered, and the incidence of coded VTEs throughout 2005. We noted that the DVT form was rarely used, even though elements of it were incorporated into other order sets. Even so, the prophylaxis rate remained in the 60 to 70% range, which, if you compare it to what Dr. Amin found, 20 to 30% range, that's actually an improvement. But it's static at that point right now. Also, the overall incidence of VTE was not decreasing. It was 2.7% in 2004, and it was 2.7% in 2005. So we had more education and refinement of the form. However, I would like to point out at this time that case review committees now had the power of institutional expectation behind them when a case was reviewed, and that process has helped to change some practice patterns. I've seen it myself. The next barrier to overcome was revealed through the process of in-depth review of every patient coded with VTE, and that is inadequate or inappropriate prophylaxis. In 2006, after we had seen no progress throughout the year of 2005, an RN auditor and myself started looking at every single coded case of DVT or PE and determining whether or not it was a complication or a naturally occurring event. With the insights garnered from this case study approach, weaknesses and failures of the system were identified. Some of them were prophylaxis was ordered and stopped for a procedure and never reordered and the patient developed a DVT. High-risk patients with only SCDs, we see that a lot, a nursing home patient who's bedbound and has all the comorbidities that just stack on top of each other and they only have SCDs ordered, which are at best, you know, marginally effective, and they get DVTs, not surprisingly. And then we have patients who are admitted to the hospital and stay 4 or 5 days before someone thinks, oh, gee, we didn't order any enoxaparin. And by that time, the clot's already formed, and you're not helping the patient any. Inadequate prophylaxis, we've seen, adds in 30 milligrams of enoxaparin for a 300-pound person, probably not effective. And a change in the patient's status not addressed with prophylaxis orders, and an example of that would be the patient having bypass surgery, who normally gets out of bed the first day, but nevertheless, this particular patient had 4 days on a vent and was not prophylaxis anyway, and he got a DVT. But no one thought to address that because in our heart surgery patients, they are not prophylaxis, so we have to deal with that with our CV surgeons. The common element seen in all these cases was a nurse at the bedside. This led to the next refinement of our process, the nurse-driven risk assessment protocol. We started a pilot of this protocol last week on two of the floors with the highest risk patients, orthopedics and oncology. You can see examples of the screens that we use in our electronic charting on the resources on the Advisor Live website. With this protocol, nurses are now expected to be part of the assessment process, thus making this aspect of prevention a shared initiative. Nurses address a 13-item list of risk factors. If the patient has at least one factor, the nurse must then determine whether or not prophylaxis is in place. If not, he or she must notify the physician and document this action. Patients are assessed on admission and with every assessment thereafter.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks to all of you for your participation and for sharing your stories with us. And that concludes our interview portion of our program. Now we'd like to go ahead and invite everyone listening to ask questions to our speakers and or pose comments they might have on what we've discussed today. So we are ready to answer your questions and respond to your comments. Please remember to tell us your name and where you're calling from, i.e. what facility. And Mark, our coordinator, will facilitate this portion. Mark?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question.
And while you are stepping up to ask your questions, let me remind you of the web address where the reference materials are located for the program today. Again, I think we've referred to those several times during the interview, and that is at www.premierinc.com/advisor-live. If you go to that website, you can download any of the reference materials that we've talked about today. We'll take our first question, please, Mark.
Okay, and our first question comes from the line of Kathy Ware from Washington County Hospital. Please proceed.
Hi, good afternoon. This first question is for Jennifer. It sounds like you've just recently implemented the nurse-driven risk assessment. Can you address when the nurses are calling the physicians? Is there a score when they call? Is it only the patients at high risk that they're notifying that there are no prophylaxis?
Okay. First of all, this is a pilot program, and we started it last week.
Okay, yeah.
I went around and checked with the nurses that are doing it, and I saw, like, 100% compliance, which is just remarkable, and they weren't having any problems with it, but they are saying, how many times do we need to call the doctor before, you know, we give up that they're not going to order anything, and what's the process for that? Well, I don't know that yet because we're just working out the bugs.
Okay.
But they call the doctor if there's one risk factor.
Oh.
And so, you know, that's pretty much everybody in the hospital.
Sure.
And so basically, pretty much the risk assessment process is to get them thinking that way, and the risk assessment has to be done every day. Now, if they're on something and it's already cool, you know, they don't have to do anything else. Just have to go through the screens, click them, and go keep on going. So,
so they're doing the risk scoring every day, every
assessment, really. We have an electronic format charting, and they have to do a nutrition assessment, and they have to do a fall risk assessment with every shift. So that's already part of Joint Commission expectations. So we just tag this onto that.
Okay, I see. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Kathy, for your question. We'll take another one, Mark.
Okay. Our next question comes from the line of Linda Brown from Borges Medical Center. Please proceed.
I just wondered if any of the speakers had had any protocols listed for bridging anticoagulation prior to surgeries.
This is Alpesh. I mean, we've put together processes working with our I run our anticoagulation clinic, and we do bridging out of our anticoagulation clinic where patients will come in to our anticoag clinic. You know, if they need to go to surgery, we would have a process where we would take them off of their Coumadin or their oral anticoagulant, and then start them on a low molecular weight heparin like enoxaparin, and then keep them on that. And depending on when their surgery is, if it's in the morning, bring them in the night before with their last dose of enoxaparin the night before, or if it's in the afternoon, maybe bring them in the morning, and then with their last dose in the morning, and then have them go through surgery, and then we'll bridge them back over after surgery and get them back out to their home. So this is better than obviously having patients come in earlier in the day, you know, earlier 2, 3, 4, 5 days before, in order to remove, put them on unfractionated heparin and so forth. So bridging has worked out pretty good for us, and we've done it in several settings.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll take our next question, please.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Mark Myodesky. Please proceed.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if there's a recommendation of which federal agencies could best follow up to do the public education campaign. It would be NIH, CDC, or ARC.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
Yes, which if there's a federal role in improving the public education to providers and to patients, which federal agency is best positioned to do that? The National Institutes of Health, Centers for Disease Control, CMS, ARC, or maybe all of the above?
Yeah, that's a good question, Dr. Amin. But the so there's lots of agencies that are involved in this at this stage. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has advocated venous thromboembolism prevention as one of its top 10 safe practices. The National Quality Forum and Joint Commission have come together, and they're now working on developing core measures that will be implemented across the United States hospitals around venous thromboembolism prevention. LeapFrog, which represents about 170 Fortune 500 companies, has advocated and supported the NQF Joint Commission measure. There's other organizations like NICE, and there's also a group of professional organizations. There's, I think, 37 or 39 professional organizations, including the major surgery, nursing, hospitalist, critical care. I mean, I could name the organizations for you. AGS is there, SHM, CHEST, or SCCM, the American Nursing Association. All of these have come together and have recommended that, venous thromboembolism is something that needs to be prevented, and they call themselves the Coalition to Prevent Venous Thromboembolism, or the Coalition to Prevent DVT, I think, is their name. So this is high on the public awareness as well as on the regulatory organizations. And by the way, most of you should probably know, but, DVT Awareness Month has been created, and for the last 3 or 4 years, March has been considered DVT Awareness Month to help increase awareness around this area, and the federal government has supported that.
Thank you, Dr. Amin. We'll take our next question, Mark.
Okay. Our next question comes from the line of Robert Tatla from St. John's. Please proceed.
Well, I was wondering if you could discuss the role of enoxaparin compared to unfractionated heparin in DVT prophylaxis in CHF patients. I think there's one study, I think it's the PRINT study, that showed a statistically significant improvement in prophylaxis with enoxaparin compared to unfractionated heparin.
Who wants to take that one?
Any of you is fine. Jennifer, do you want to try it?
Well, I don't know that I can address the CHF population, but I know that I've studied unfractionated heparin versus enoxaparin, so I can educate physicians around the hospital. And basically, unfractionated heparin TID is similar to enoxaparin once a day, okay? But the pharmacodynamics of unfractionated heparin are so unpredictable that I think that enoxaparin is a more predictable and a more steady-state kind of drug. But nevertheless, when you're looking at studies, you have to have, they're usually considered equal. But if you read between the lines, you'll find that that's only when you're using heparin 3 times a day.
Anything else?
Do you guys agree?
Yeah, well, so I think the PRINT study was a head-to-head study, as you all probably remember. It was a head-to-head study that looked at enoxaparin versus unfractionated heparin, and actually it looked at it with unfractionated heparin given at the 3 times a day dosage as opposed to 5,000 BID, which is probably important from that perspective in and of itself, that there was a that was looked at in that light as opposed to BID dosing. And what we had found in the PRINT study was that, and as was mentioned before, is that there was a significant reduction in
venous thromboembolism by using enoxaparin over unfractionated heparin. The other piece that was found, and certainly in the heart failure population, enoxaparin had better, statistically significant, better outcomes than unfractionated heparin at three times a day. But the other piece that that also was found in these studies is that, you know, from the safety profile, there was less heparin-induced thrombocytopenia with the low molecular weight heparin, as well as less bleeding risk with the low molecular weight heparin compared to unfractionated heparin. So not only did you get it on the efficacy side, but you also got it on the prevention side, which became very important in and of itself. Did that help answer your question?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Donna Mobley from Mississippi Baptist Medical Center. Please proceed.
Yeah, I would like to address this question to Spartanburg. Our hospital is roughly the same size and demographics, I think, as yours. We have created an order sheet very, very similar to the one that we see here that you've got. It's remarkably similar. Our problem has been in getting physician use of this. I was wondering if you had any tips at all, if you said you're at 70% use of this sheet, or did I miss?
No, actually, we have use of the sheet is about 5 to 10%. Of charts that are audited, and we look to see if the sheets are being used. But what's happened is the education and bringing this situation to the forefront of physicians' minds has caused pieces of this to be supplemented into other order forms. So orthopedic order forms have DVT prophylaxis in it. Oncology admission order form now has DVT prophylaxis in it. Our hospitalist order form now has DVT prophylaxis in it. So the rate of prophylaxis has increased, although the order form as the tool, it has not been used too well. And I don't really know how to combat that, because it's been a constant problem.
That's been exactly our experience, that it seems to be increasing awareness, but
right.
The tool itself has not been used.
So in that regard, you know, I guess you could say it's a success. It's working somehow, but...
We are in the process of doing a chart review to get those exact numbers, and we don't have the numbers yet, but I think our experience sounds exactly like yours.
Uh-huh. Well, you can give me a call. You can get my number from Kelly or whatever when we're over, and we can compare numbers later on down the road if you want to.
Yeah, you could do that. You could send an email to advisorlive@premierinc.com, and I'll make sure to get your contact information to one another if you'd like. We'll take the next question, please.
Absolutely. Our next question comes from the line of Mary Date from Emmanuel St. Joseph. Please proceed.
Hi, this is Mary Date. As I'm listening to your conversation here, we had a remarkably similar experience also where our first pass was an order set for physicians to implement. It did require them to rank the person's risk according to the ACCP guidelines, and our results were also quite dismal, and so we've taken another approach in putting together a nurse-driven protocol whereby nurses are can use all of the mechanical devices, can apply the stockings, can apply SCDs, and if the person ranks high or extremely high on the risk scale, then we'll call the physician to get a medication order as well. And our compliance has really improved quite a bit since we've taken this approach, and I'm just putting it out there as a possibility for consideration.
Hi, you know, I think that gets to the point of hardwiring an approach in your institution because, you know, quite frankly, with practice getting so complicated, unless you do that, patients and situations fall between the cracks, there are missed opportunities, and whether you're an electronic shop or a paper shop, you have to figure out a way to hardwire this so that it gets applied to every single patient that we touch. Otherwise, you know, the results in terms of the number of patients who suffer this complication and complications from DVT is just going to stay as high as it is now.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Absolutely. Our next question comes from the line of Laura Larkin from Alexian Brothers Medical Center. Please proceed.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any information regarding the evidence of the efficacy of plantar pneumatic compression devices and SCDs.
Dr. Amin, do you want to take that one?
I'm sorry, one more time, what was that question?
Okay, is there any evidence, is there any literature to support the efficacy of the plantar pneumatic compression device or the SCDs?
Yeah, well, so if you look at the mechanical devices, I think there's a few things. One is, you know, pharmacological agents such as low molecular weight heparin or the even unfractionated heparin 5000 TID, you know, have been given 1A recommendations by the National Chest Guidelines for prevention of venous thromboembolism. Whereas mechanical devices have been given a 1C recommendation based on the evidence, and there's even soft evidence that supports the idea that, you know, you need to keep these mechanical devices on for 20, 21 hours a day in order to prevent venous thromboembolism. So, you know, here's my problem with this stuff is obviously there is a reason, you know, first of all, when you think about this in logical format, a 1A recommendation, it just means by national guidelines that there's enough evidence to support and there's enough randomized controlled trials to support the usage of pharmacologic agents in the prevention of venous thromboembolism. It doesn't necessarily tell you which one is better or which one is not. It just tells you that there's evidence to support it.
Mm-hmm.
Next step is you as an institution have to think about, you know, which what are some of the benefits of one versus the other in terms of compliance, bleeding risk, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, nursing time, number of injections, you know, patient satisfaction, so forth and so forth. The other piece is when you start thinking about 1C recommendations, it means that there's not a lot of evidence out there. And it doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't use mechanical devices, but I'm not sure it should be the frontline choice because now, except in a couple of unique situations, if patients have a high risk of bleeding, you're not going to give them a pharmacologic anticoagulant. And if patients need maybe synergistic double coverage, if you like, for prophylaxis, you know, in a high risk patient who also is undergoing orthopedic surgery with 3 to 5 risk factors or something like that, you might want to think of using both a pharmacologic agent plus a mechanical device to get the biggest bang for the buck that you can. But routine prophylaxis with the mechanical device, you know, is somewhat contradicted in the way we practice because on one end we kind of sit back and I'm sure in your hospital, Joint Commission requires every hospital to have a restraint policy.
Correct.
So if you have a restraint policy, the reason we have it is to not use restraints unless they're absolutely indicated because, you know, there's been enough literature to say restraints cause delirium, falls, injuries, skin breakdown, infections, so forth. Well, if that's the case and you're putting somebody just routinely that could take a pharmacologic agent and you're putting them on a mechanical device for 21 out of 24 hours, isn't that like a restraint? And so, you know, so we've got to kind of make sure that what we're thinking about and what we're doing is the right thing. So I'm not saying we shouldn't use it. I'm just saying that there's probably a case where we should use it or cases where we should use it, but it should be individualized. But when you're talking about mass prevention or developing a protocol process for prevention, I'm, you know, in general, I think a 1A recommendation that doesn't also contradict your restraint policy may make more sense.
Thank you very much.
And we have time for about 2 more questions. Mark, if you would, please.
Perfect. Our next question comes from the line of Judy King from Rogue Valley Medical Center. Please proceed.
Hi, we actually have a couple questions, quick questions. The first one is whether or not you are aware of any guidelines or recommendations for the pregnant patient who is having a C-section.
I'm not aware of specific guidelines, Al.
Yeah, the guidelines, specifically for C-sections are, you know, you could go back and there's some guidelines in the CHEST guidelines that will talk about pregnant patients and how to deal with them specifically. But when you're undergoing a C-section, you know, I think you're going to have to individualize it to the individual patient and consider, again, risk benefits. And, you know, it's like any other patient that's undergoing a bleeding risk. Certainly there is or undergoing a major surgery. There's certainly risk for bleeding, but once the bleeding is controlled, if you feel like you're not able to get the patient up and moving, there might be a role for prevention.
Okay, thank you. And we have one more question. We're just at the beginning of our process here, and so we have several samples of VTE prophylaxis risk factor assessments and order sets, but they all seem to weigh the different risk factors differently as far as the points that are attributed and how you make them into low, medium, or high risk. I'm wondering if there's any research or evidence base that you can share with us so that we can correctly weigh the risk factors in our protocols.
What protocols are these? Where are these protocols? I'm sorry?
We just have samples from other hospitals, and it seems that everybody weighs the risk factors differently as far as the points that are allocated. And we're just wondering where, you know, if there's evidence out there on how they need to be weighed.
Well, I think you're going to find folks that have looked at various different hospital folks that have looked at this internally at their hospital. They're going to look at the literature that they find and try to develop something that they believe works for their hospital. I think there's a few things that you need to take a step back on, though. The first is that you know. Do you really need to do a point system at the end of the day? I mean, you know, one of the things that we did at our institution is we decided not to use a point system. We decided to say, you know, if patients were undergoing a major surgery with more than two significant risk factors, that probably is going to put them in the highest risk category. And so then what do you do for those patients? So it made it a bit easier for us to kind of think through this because we just basically said low risk, medium risk, high risk, and highest risk. And then we had criteria to put patients into those categories. I know that other people have looked at points as a mechanism to do that. But then there's the other process. So can I give you one place that's considered the gold standard in terms of evidence? Probably not. I can't give you one article or anything like that. I think you're going to have to sit down with your group and say, do you want a point system or do you want a more of a general system, and how do you want to allocate it looking at the research that exists out there? But I think the other question that you're going to need to think about is, you know, some people are now talking about the concept of, instead of forcing people to go through a process that says, you know, you've got to justify why patients need to be prophylaxed, others are starting to say, you know what, if there is such an opportunity to prevent venous thromboembolism, maybe what we ought to do is consider everybody should get some form of prophylaxis and they should justify why they don't give it, which is a different concept. So that's something worth thinking about as you're developing this.
Okay, thank you.
And we have time for one more question. Mark, if you would, please.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Rebecca Redding from Randolph Hospital. Please proceed.
Yes, thank you. What I wanted to ask was particularly about calf versus thigh high for stockings or IPCs, et cetera.
I'm sorry, this is Alpesh again. I missed your question because I got paged at the same time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Some of our doctors are insisting on thigh-high mechanical devices, and then other places we've seen that calf is just as good as thigh-high, and was wondering if you had any definitive direction on that.
I know that there's people have been debating this lately. Our perspective has always been that thigh high probably may offer a little bit better protection. But can I quote you specific literature that totally supports that over the other one, I'm not sure I can.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thanks, everybody. That brings us to the end of our call for today. A special thanks to our speakers, and thanks to everyone on the line for participating. Please check your email for a link to our web-based program evaluation, which you should be receiving shortly. By filling out this evaluation, you will be able to request more information and suggest other topics for future programs. You also can reach us with additional questions at the following email address, advisorlive@premierinc.com. Again, advisorlive@premierinc.com. Remember, Advisor Live is open to anyone, and it is at no charge. Take care, everybody, and goodbye from Premier.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. We thank you very much for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.